underwriting support for the Book Show podcast on WAMC.org comes from Northshire Bookstore, Manchester Center, Vermont, and Saratoga Springs, New York. An independent bookstore offering books, author events, gifts for children and adults, and more. Northshire.com. And from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a new Bachelor of Science degree in Public Health with a focus on social, physical, and behavioral sciences. strose.edu.
Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Nick Harkaway is the author of such novels as The Gone Away World and Tiger Man. His latest, Gnomon, is set in a near-future high-tech surveillance state that is equal parts dark comedy, detective story, and mind-bending philosophical puzzle. In the world of Gnomon, citizens are constantly observed and democracy has reached a pinnacle of transparency. Every action is seen, every word is recorded, and the system has access to its citizens' thoughts and memories, all in the name of providing the safest society in history. The novel is a mix of sci-fi, mystery, politics, and literary fiction, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Nick Harkaway to this week's Book Show. Nick, thank you very much for being with us. What a great pleasure.
Hi.
What brought you to this world?
Well, I started writing in about 2014, and I was concerned that in British politics at the time there was a kind of wishy-washy centrism which I felt had a deep authoritarian streak in it. So I started writing a book as a warning about that, and it took me slightly too long. And in 2016, I realized I'd been completely outpaced by the course of events. I'd like to apologize for not issuing my warning until after the authoritarian streak had bitten. So now I'm just writing kind of state of the disunion. But I mean, you know, actually, more seriously, I think the discussion of surveillance and the technologies of surveillance and of other things that we have coming along is a really important cultural discussion that we need to be having.
So let us talk about that high-tech surveillance state that you write about. Give us a sense, because as you say, that this is dystopian and yet less so than you had intended.
Way less so than I'd intended. And in fact, I have this conversation about whether the book is dystopian, and I start to worry that even with the flaws in the society in the book, it might be nicer than the one I actually live in. The basic premise is there is a society in which the bargain, I guess, is you are totally transparent as a citizen, and it's a rolling plebiscite. Everything is voted on. There's no representation. Everything is directly governed. And so everybody votes on their phone, on their device all the time, and that's how the society works. And for the most part, it's absolutely fantastic. But there are some sort of backwaters where it becomes problematic, and in one of those, a kind of angry old lady is arrested and brought in for interrogation, and when they interrogate you, they just read your mind straight out. And when they read her mind, they find a bunch of things in there which are impossible. They can't possibly be there. And then under interrogation, she dies, and off we go into the story. And so it's immediately the investigator is a big believer in the system, but she's going to be challenged on that.
Before we get into the story itself, let me just focus on two words that you used in the novel. One is that in England, in this novel, it is governed by the system. Talk about the system.
Well, the system is this architecture of ubiquitous surveillance, and it's every device, every place is surveilled, and that's known and it's accepted. It's not a kind of sinister thing for anybody, and indeed, it's hugely useful. Like, we're having a conversation, and let's meet next week, and my calendar and your calendar sort of negotiate, and the system clears everything for us and makes some space, and we know when we're coming. And then maybe 2 days before, I put my clothes in the washing machine, the water sample goes to the central system, and the system says, "Oh, you're getting sick. You're going to need to move that appointment you have 2 days from now because you're going to be ill then." Well, and so on. Everything is sort of part of this mixture. And the system takes care of you, and everybody is equally seen. No one falls through the cracks. It's a very benign, said he, it's a very benign thing.
So we are all created equal in the system.
Absolutely. Enthusiastically so.
The other word, the other name that you have in the book is the witness, which is a police force. Talk about the witness.
The witness. The witness is, as you say, is the investigative branch, and they are the, you know, the system is not, it's not conscious, it's not a conscious AI, so we're not dealing with HAL. It's very much a system of responses and algorithms. And so, you know, you have people in the mixture to work as a cutout, to make sure that everything remains fair, and to investigate any criminal cases that come up which are too complex, too nuanced for the system to deal with. So there is, and they're sort of not just police officers, but as it were, kind of roving prosecutors and at the same time maybe counselors. You know, there's, again, it's this sort of very strong sense that it's a benign system of intervention. And of course, this is our hero, is Miliki Neath, who is the investigator, the inspector assigned to this case.
And the opening sentence of the book, the death of a suspect in custody is a very serious matter. So as you say, this, we're off to the races, and you send us off to the races very quickly.
Yeah, I think, I mean, particularly with a book that's long and complex, which this one is, although I hope that I managed to kind of nail it down so that it flows through, you've got to get into the action very quickly. You want to assure people that, you know, this is going to be, we're going to go to a lot of strange places. You know, we're going into the past, to the late Roman Empire. We're going to the financial crisis in Greece. We're going to Ethiopia in the 1970s, and we're going to the very far future. But all the same, we're always coming back along this track of Miliki Neath investigating this thing, and this is the point of inception. Is here is this woman, and she is dead, and we have to know why.
Give us a sense of Neath as an investigator and as a character, as a fictional character.
She is, as I think I said, she's extremely enthusiastic about the society in which she lives. She's a deeply invested believer in what is, as far as she's concerned, the most responsive, reflexive democracy ever created. And she's also, by definition, she's quite professional. She has there's a general sense maybe within the witness organization that she needs to spend a little bit more time kind of on her own life and kind of, you know, enjoying herself as somebody who's always sort of looking over her shoulder to make sure that she's okay. Very much one of those sort of driven characters, and she's on the up, she's well respected, and this case comes to her because she is absolutely the right person for it.
And able to literally insert herself into the memories and the imagination of the victim.
Well, this is the kind of gizmo in the story. This is the MacGuffin, is that they have this sort of mind-reading machine. And in 2014, when I began writing it, I essentially invented this technology, and I said, okay, so you put a chitosan chip into the brain, and then you can sort of borrow the information in the brain and sort of have a record of it and so on. In fact, I was outmatched again, by this time by the technology. In summer 2017, there's a Professor Doris Chow, I think, at Caltech, and her team announced that they had pulled a passport photo quality image from the brains of monkeys, apparently, according to the, when she was making a sort of statement about this, her colleague brought her the output and showed her the picture that they'd got, and she said, "Did you accidentally copy and paste the input? Because the clarity of the image is so good." So I was outpaced. You know, I envisaged that as a technology we wouldn't have for a long time. I knew there was a project in Japan to read sort of vague, slightly strange images from dreams, but the resolution seems to have gotten better and better over these years. So now, you know, and this is one of the things I think it's really important that we discuss this as a culture, because we need to talk about this before the society of the witness or the system and the witness becomes an actual tangible possibility.
But there's also, in going into the mind, we realize all of these various corners. You explore these. These are character studies of these worlds that are constructed by the victim.
Exactly. Yeah, we have sort of these subsidiary narratives which are inside Hunter's head, and supposedly the only thing that should be in her head is her life history. But instead, there are these other characters. You have Konstantin Kyriakos, the banker, Athenaeus Carthaginensis, Berihan Bekele, and the title character, Gnomon. And there, as you say, each of them has a little story to tell. There's a kind of sense that it's unclear whether they might be more real or less real. You know, this is a book which is, as well as being about surveillance, is also kind of alchemy and semiotics and murder and so on. I had great fun writing this.
Do you take those separately? They're almost mini. I mean, there are mini stories. So do you almost take those separately?
I had this delusion when I started writing that I would write those individually, separately, as little kind of, you know, as little stories unto themselves, and then somehow I would sort of bind them together. And very early on, I discovered that the process was going to take a lot longer because they have to feed tightly into one another. And so what actually was happening was, instead of writing each one linearly and then plumbing them together, I was writing them more like a 3D printer prints going across the whole thing. And I had to sort of refer from one to the other to the other to make them play. And then when I was editing, I had to do it all again. And for me, that process was really extraordinarily new, because I generally like to plan quite heavily. I like to know where I'm going, and I like to carry the whole text of the book as far as I can in my head, so that when I'm writing a scene, I know exactly where it fits into the book and what it's got to do and so on. And in this situation, I had to almost kind of take a given narrative as a parcel, like a kind of closed segment, and know that it had the following sort of 3-4 demands on the others, and I would have to write those, and then I would lock another section away. And by the time I got to the end of that process, I'd have all the kind of locked away sections on one side and the last section on the, and then I'd finish the last section and know that I had to go right back to the beginning of the others, because things had happened in the writing which required that the supposedly locked sections be changed. It was a very intensive process.
Nick Harkaway is the author of the new novel Gnomon. It is published by Knopf. In this book, in this literary novel, there is a great deal and a great hat tipped to the literary, isn't there?
Yes. I mean, I have in the past, I've written novels which have kind of been in the crossover zone and so on, but I've always veered off from being too literary. I think I have a very kind of classically English perception that to be too sort of literary and ostensibly, the word that I'm frightened of is ostentatiously kind of intellectual or whatever, is somehow blowing your own trumpet. And this time I confessed to myself when I started that I was writing a properly literary novel, and I had to do a lot of kind of growing up as a writer in that way, in the sense that I had to admit to myself that I was going to, if people were going to turn around to me and say, well, I mean, you know, you've just gone too far into the literary here, and you're really, you know, actually you're not up to it, I would have to carry that. And thank goodness, it seems as if I came out the far end relatively unscathed in that process. And I get to say, yes, this is a literary book, and yes, it is unapologetically complex, but I believe that it's really, when you get into it, it'll pull you in, and you know, you won't resent that decision. But it was quite a deep breath moment for me.
Let us talk a moment about that complexity, because it's one of the things that fascinated me about the novel, because it seemed, I was worried that I was going to lose my place at some point, and I never did. And I'm interested in your writing. If you were concerned about that, not so much about my capacities, but about in the storytelling of keeping all of that together.
No, I was terrified of that in both directions. I was terrified that I would write something where you couldn't hold the thread. And my salvation in that context was in part that detective story structure, because the great thing about a detective story structure is that there is a crime, an investigation, and a solution. And as long as you know that and I deliver that, we can go anywhere together. And we'll always come home, you know. So that's I think the thing without which I could not have landed this. And then in the context of writing, this is the first book I've ever written that I was 2/3 of the way through, and I honestly wasn't sure I was going to make it to the end. I thought for a little while, have I taken on something that's just smarter than I am, and I can't do this. The thing about writing novels, and this is the thing that writers say to each other a lot when you're in that space with a book where you're just kind of like, oh my God, this is beating me, is that you just put one foot in front of the other and you keep going. And sooner or later, the dawn comes, the sun rises, and you're kind of like, oh, this problem I have over here is solving this problem back here. Like the two of them, when you put them together, they fix one another, because I did my work in the first chapters. But with this, because of the complexity, yeah, no, I was genuinely scared of it. I mean, it was tough.
What is, in keeping all of that, if the plate's spinning, as it were, and going back to the earlier questions of in these character studies of writing those separately, but when you put it all together, what is the revision like of looking back at it and say, okay, what, how do I keep all of this to still make sense for me and to be the story I want it to be?
I mean, the editorial process was extraordinary because apart from anything else, there would be moments in the conversation with Edward Kastenmeier and his amazing team at Knopf. I could not have landed this without them and without the guys in London, Jason Arthur and so on. I would just have lost it. But they would be saying to me, Nick, you know, this section over here, it isn't really working for us. You know, can we move it around? Can we change it? And I would go into it and I would do something with it. And that would be fine. But then the next time someone would say that, I'd be like, we can't change that, but I can't tell you why. Like, I don't remember anymore. But I know that that box has a red line around it. If I change that, something else will fall out of the book, but I no longer know what that is. The process of writing this for me, and particularly of editing it, was like a dialogue with a non-speaking version of myself that would kind of sit there and go, nope, can't do that, you know, but not explain why. And it was a really extraordinary experience. And they were incredibly patient with me about it. And we would sort of work through these knots. And, you know, and both Jason and Edward would be saying, Nick, you know, every so often you're going to have to stop and just gloss this and give people just a little bit more kind of signposting so that, you know, so that they don't feel lost, so that they know that it will continue to deliver the kind of the answers. And it was a really great editorial process because I think the end result that we delivered was the right one.
Did you have a natural inclination to bring these elements of mythology and images from mythology and of the traditional detective fiction and even various points of view? Did you always have that intention, or was that a more natural part of the process that just brought you there?
It was the hunger that I had when I started the book. It was one of the things that I wanted. I had recently discovered Borges, and I've always loved Umberto Eco. And as I was talking earlier about sort of the sense of growing up, I had to confess to myself that I wanted to write in that tradition. And when you read some of the Borges stories, that some of them are wonderfully atmospherically noirish and so on, and others are very magical realist and so on. So there's a whole depth of stuff going on there. And those guys combine those things in this extraordinary way. And I wanted to do that too and see whether I could. And that sort of sense of, you know, we have, when we go back in time, we have this extraordinary woman who's an alchemist. And so we have all the symbols of that sort of going on. And she's the jilted lover of St. Augustine. And that, incidentally, is a real thing. Augustine had a child with a woman whose name history doesn't recall. And I wanted to take her story and put it out there and say, look, you know, she was important too.
Is that genetic in a writer, and especially genetic for you as the son of John le Carré?
I mean, obviously, my father hasn't written about mythology per se, but he's, on the other hand, created his own mythos. You know, he has this extraordinary erudition, which is, you know, it is enviable to me. Quotes from Goethe flow from him quietly without, you know, without difficulty in the original German. And I sort of sit there and go, well, I can't do that. But genetic, I don't know about. But certainly, I was raised in a house that was full of stories. We tell stories to each other as a way, like when I come back from this trip, you know, as a way of kind of refreshing our acquaintance, we'll tell each other stories about what's been going on. I'll talk about what's happened on the trip, and I'll get from my parents what's been going on with them back home. And we exchange stories and we laugh. And that's how we kind of reassure each other that we're still here.
I'm always interested in this topic because, of course, Stephen King has two sons, both are writers. One is Owen King, who uses the King name. One is Joe Hill, who does not. And both are very, very good writers. And to just realize what you want to do and to maneuver yourself to a point where you are taken for your own work, is that something that was a pressure, is a pressure, or is something you just can't worry about?
It's kind of all of those things. You can't worry about it. You just got to get on with it. Because otherwise, you just live with the yips. You'll never do anything. You know, I used to say that it didn't bother me at all, and that I sort of was, as it were, respectful of it as a thing because it felt like standing next to a lighthouse, holding a lighted match, and kind of trying to help the shipping. The more I think about it, the more I think that I was actually more kind of concerned about it back then than I am now. And the question is always going to come up. There's no point being grouchy about it. You just answer it. It's actually genuinely interesting. I mean, you know, one of the great sort of pleasures of this book coming out was Michael Verda writing in the Washington Post and actually actively comparing Gnomon with Tinker, Tailor, Soldier, Spy and saying, you know, there's an echo here, which, you know, is fascinating to me. And it's something that came up in the UK as well, the possibility of sort of an actual confluence of my writing with my father's, which, you know, you can't argue with it. I mean, he's an extraordinary writer. And to my vast irritation, he only seems to get better. How is that fair? I know Joe Hill a little bit now, and everybody always expects us to talk about fathers all the time, and I suspect that Joe is one of a vanishingly small number of people in the world with whom I don't have to have that conversation.
Right, you just know.
He already knows.
Sure, you know exactly what it's like. But it must have just enormous pride for you to have the work, the body of work that you have, and look at it and say, wow, I have done something. It is very different. It's something that, much like, as you say, your father's work is just seems to be maturing and growing and becoming better and better.
First of all, thank you for that. That's the definition of happiness in writing. Yes, it is actually, as I get to having written enough books to start talking about like a body of work, it does feel like a coming of age, you know. But it's very funny. I mean, I was talking about this the other day and saying, you know, wow, you know, this is my fourth novel, my fifth book, and you know, it was a hard one. I did worry about finishing it, and Dad's kind of sitting there, yeah, you want to try the 22nd. 22nd's the hardest, you know, because, you know, that feeling never goes away. It's always there. So, you know, that's reassuring, too, in its own slightly disturbing way.
What is it like to remove yourself from this world? I ask you this question because it took me a while, a couple of days. I dreamt differently after finishing this novel. I thought differently. And I was just thinking of you as the writer, of being in this world of complexity for so long, of the reemergence, of the reentry of you, if you will, into another world.
Well, I mean, it is. It's an extraordinary thing. I mean, and for me, it's a while ago, but I still have those echoes. And I mean, one of the things that happened while I was writing the book was I became very conscious about online security, you know, just as a matter of course now. You know, I use a secure email server in Switzerland. I have a VPN network, not as a kind of, there's nothing in my communications that's particularly interesting to anybody, but I suddenly became conscious that most of the stuff that we do online, we do as if we're walking down the street in a bath towel, you know, at best. Email is a postcard, not a letter. Everything is written in the open. And actually, that's a little bit odd. You know, that's a slightly strange thing to do. So, you know, I became sort of conscious of all that stuff. And it's actually very easy to fix, you know. So I did all that. Beyond that, one of the strange experiences was the realization when I was writing the book, there was a sort of strange sense that more than other books even, which I believe are this anyway, it was a statement of myself put into text. And I mean, and there's reference to that in the book itself. I felt that I was writing a book which almost was like an offsite backup, that you would all be carrying a little part of me around. And, you know, so that was a form of immortality. And then when the book was published, I realized that I had continued to live. And I was a different person now from when I put the final full stop on. So it's no longer an up-to-date backup. It's frustratingly, that's another person now, because I finished a book in 2016 for the first time. That now is the statement of my identity in 2016, not the statement of me now. So it no longer works as my functional immortality. It has to be, I have to do the next book to get that.
So with that in mind, and with the idea of the next book, and given what we were talking about at the beginning of our conversation, that you felt you came, you know, just got here a little too late as to what you originally intended, does that have an impact on the idea for the next project?
I'm fascinated, as I was when I was writing Gnomon. I mean, all this stuff sort of hangs around in my head and occasionally collides with something, and sort of then I suddenly have an idea for a novel. I'm fascinated at the moment by the idea of the liquid society, the liquid modernity, so this notion that we all locate ourselves as who we are by reference to a number of points, which used to be, let's say, church, family, state, where we're born, and so on. And as modernity has changed all the sort of the power of those things, you know, you're no longer likely to be born and die within 2 miles of the same place. Some of those tethers have snapped loose and are flapping around, and the consequence of that is that many people take refuge in things like ethno-nationalism and so on. I was asking myself, what is the next stage of that? As we look at the sort of biotechnology and the advances in mind-machine interfaces, what happens when baseline humanity, your genetic identity, is no longer set from birth? You know, you can change that if it doesn't work, or you can acquire some kind of augmentation if you need to be better at arithmetic, which is something I would like to be. How does that change who we are, and how will people respond to that possibility when you have, I guess, evaporated modernity? And so I want to look at things that will do that to us, that will cause us to doubt and misunderstand and be uncertain about who we are as human beings on an even more fundamental level. And I think I've got a few years yet before that really starts to bite. So I figure if I work quickly, I should be okay this time.
Well, the new novel, which is wonderful and quite unforgettable, is Gnomon. It is published by Knopf. Nick Harkaway, a great pleasure. Thank you very much for spending time with us.
Thank you so much.
Nick Harkaway's new novel is Gnomon. It's spelled G-N-O-M-O-N. It is published by Knopf. We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org. You can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week. And thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.